I think it was a dream of many that when our land claims were settled, we would own and rule our land. This does not seem to be the case. They seem to regulate, or they still regulate, our land by the state and federal fish and game, by EPA, by coastal zone management, and by BLM's easements, rights of ways, and countless other ways that seem to crop up as the immigrants need them. Our land is cut into many pieces by outdated, current, and future easements and right-of-ways that have been, are, or may be needed by the immigrant public. I personally feel that it wasn't intended that we own our land very long. You know, for instance, conveyance of those lands by legislation of both houses and signed by the president specifically stated that all land be conveyed or to be conveyed would be conveyed within 5 years. And, you know, this Public Law 92-203 is supposed to be the supreme law of the land, yet the bureaucracy, Congress's hirelings, have chosen to ignore that law and in 12 years have not completed conveyance. You know, I mean, this goes to show that the people who run the government can ignore the law whenever they want, yet we have to comply with the letter of the law. You know, this raises the question, who runs our country? The Senate and House of Representatives, or a bunch of bureaucrats that work for them? You know, it's asked, what are the moral and ethical principles upon which our claims are based? I think first that the following questions need to be answered. When were our people ever conquered by either the United States of America or Russia? What gave Russia the right to sell to the United States anything but the buildings that they built on Eskimo, Aleut, or Tlingit lands? If they did not give the Alaskan natives his aboriginal rights, who gave them the right to extinguish them? When did the United States ever negotiate with any of the major tribes of Alaska to take over our tribal leadership? If we must discuss the moral and ethical principles before those questions are asked, I would have to ask more questions. Did the negotiations on the part of the United States actually see ANCSA as a benefit to the Alaska Natives? Did our leaders and the leaders of the United States sit down to discuss and analyze the outcome of ANCSA? Why has BLM not completed the conveyance of our lands within the time frame allocated by law? Why must we always comply with the law and regulations when the bureaucracy is charged with enforcement may choose to bend or completely ignore that law? Why has BLM allowed so many of these immigrants to come in and establish camps, summer homes, and sometimes businesses on lands that had been frozen by federal government until we were conveyed our land selections? You know, in 1969, 2 years before land claims was passed, the land that we were supposed to select from was frozen, yet people have settled on them, they've camped on them, they've done everything on those lands that we couldn't do because they were frozen. Excuse me. I think you can look at the history of the European Western culture since they have landed on the North American continent. In my travels, I have yet to meet an Indian from any Indian tribe who feels that the United States has ever lived up to any of the treaties that they have signed with any of the American Indian tribes. They have always found ways of slowly eroding away anything they have conceded to us as they needed it. I think our people are justly concerned that the immigrants are already in the process of eroding not only our land by easements, rights of ways, invalid claims, and squatting, but our corporations by sale of stock. I personally feel that the architects of ANCSA were very unethical. I think they spent many hours devising pitfalls for us to fail, thus bringing them closer to total control. They knew that not enough Alaskan natives understood corporate procedures and laws and would have to bring their people as consultants and often as their chief executive officers. Our own regional corporation made several investments where someone made money, but we didn't. Of course, we can't blame all our failures on these outsiders, but, when they were our chief consultants, where else can we go? The newcomers in the last 117 years have done more to damage our lands and hunting and trapping and fishing than the Alaska Natives have done since, as many have said, in the past time immemorial. They've taken millions of dollars out of Alaska from our minerals. They've done this while putting little back into the land. The oil companies have continuously cried about the cost of drilling for oil in Alaska, but you never hear them cry about the more than $35 billion they've taken out since they've started producing their wells. And we are in a difficult position today. We want to continue our traditional hunting and fishing. And I know that I might survive without it, but there's a lot of people that won't. But I would definitely be very unhappy if I could not get an occasional meal of our native foods. I personally don't hunt as much as my family used to, but I still enjoy the old traditional way of sharing and trading for native foods. But we also today live in a Western monetary society. How many of us would survive today without it? It's difficult to say. We've got to live in two different worlds today. I don't know the answer, and I can only see what has happened in the past and worry about what may happen in the future. We hope that you can take our concerns and come up with some possible solutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
My name is Perry Mendenhall. I'm on the board of Quark Incorporated, also on the board of the Sauk Native Corporation, and on the Nome Eskimo Community IRA Council. And I've been in education since 1972 when I graduated from Fairbanks University. And I attained my master's from University of Oregon, and I'm now working for the University of Alaska. Topic, being an educator, my topic is having to deal with land claims curriculum. And the way that this came about was about a year and a half ago, there was an annual meeting of the Bering Straits Women's Spirit Rising Committee conference. And they had existed for about 2 years, and that was their second year last year when they had their conference. And why they didn't have another one, I don't know. It could be maybe the word Bering Straits Women's Spirit Rising Conference was scary to some people in this region. Maybe church groups thought they were going back to shamanism or whatever. Or else some people were probably scared of grassroots coming up and saying something about the land claims. And there's two assumptions that I had, or else they didn't quite understand what that movement was about, what they wanted to do, or else they also perhaps run out of funding. But the Bering Straits Women's Spirit Rising Conference was held in Nome, Alaska, during March 1983. This second annual conference was conducted by a group of women for the purpose of having women voice their concerns on social, health, economic and educational issues through formal resolutions that they have passed. During the formal workshops, at least 125 women participated and represented 19 villages from a region, which is our region, Bering Straits. Their cultural backgrounds were Northern Inupiaq, Southern Inupiaq, Mainland Yupik, Siberian Yupik, and Caucasian. Majority were Alaska Natives. Their experiences, employment, varied widely from the traditional lifestyles to the modern 20th century woman, village housewife to the urban housewife, clerical and administrative positions, educators for colleges and school districts, newspaper reporters and students. Guest speakers, observers, and facilitators represented business agencies, native and state agencies, social health welfare staff, lawyers, educators, housewives, and village elders. They have seen these women work, deal with, and react to such topics as outer continental shelf, Sail 57 Norton Sound, oil impact, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, 1991 stock and land issues, school districts and university educational programs, and social health alcohol problems. Observers, presenters, and leaders went away from this conference impressed by the Women's Conference's serious handling of complex issues and wanting to know answers or possible solutions to such issues. The Native Corporation personnel and Native agencies were amazed as to the high level of questions they were having to respond to on AINSCA. The women wanted to know how they can support AINSCA, yet they admitted that they know very little about it. Upon hearing about the year 1991 and its implications to AINSCA, they supported two resolutions which are closely related: the education of stockholders and school children, from an introductory level on up to the complex land claims bill itself, with updating process built in. Before going on, of course, you've probably been hearing all of this. I sort of described the land claims bill. You want me to continue?
Yeah, go ahead, sure. No, I'm here to
let us look briefly at AINSCA. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is a piece of federal legislation describing the express procedures whereby land and resource settlement is to be achieved over a 20-year process. This settlement meant that the Alaska Natives would receive title to 40 million acres in compensation amounting to $962.5 million, of which $462.5 million was to come from the federal treasury and the rest from mineral revenue sharing. 12 regional corporations would administer the settlement. And then I have a figure diagram illustrating the land and money conveyance down to the Native individual. The preceding figure looks simple. A lot of Native leaders would like to see the act this simple, but the common Alaska Native layperson from a village does not realize that it is a complex settlement, requiring a lot of steady work for its implementation. The Settlement Act is a complex settlement of a complex situation. Some of its provisions are susceptible to differing interpretations, the more so because there are three parties at interest: the Natives, the state of Alaska, and the federal government, which still has vast riches and vast responsibilities in Alaska. Many problems have arisen already, and many more will arise in the implementation of the law. Enactment required goodwill and broad statesmanship. Fulfillment of the spirit and the letter of this historic legislation will require the same great qualities. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is monumental legislation of which all Americans, Native and non-Natives, can be proud. And this was Stuart French, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the Arctic Institute of North America, written in August 1972. That was his quotation. A Native whose language usage is chiefly Eskimo and whose formal educational background is close to nil, and his grocery store is the sea and open country with some Sears Roebuck's clothing, some 20th century hunting and fishing gear, and easily influenced by the newly installed village TV, knows too well that AINSCA is indeed complex and alien to his way of thinking after some study. For the past 12 years, or 13 years now, he or she has trusted the easily elected and appointed board of directors, along with staff and the lawyers, to shift through AINSCA's complexity. The benefits are few thus far for us. Questions are being asked, and there is a high demand for explanations.
They want to know and understand the birthright they have inherited through ANSCA. They are asking to become more involved with the ANSCA process in their village and at the regional and state level. The figure following briefly illustrates the complexity of ANSCA. And I have the diagram taken out of Bob Arnold's text, which shows the complexity of it. The women at this conference acknowledged that ANSCA was indeed complex in its present form, and yet it affects the very future of their existence. They desire that not only they should be educated and active with ANSCA, but that their own children should be taught ANSCA in their schools. For the women realize that if they lose the land through ANSCA, they lose a way of life and the means for their existence. At the present time within the Bering Straits region, there are no required ANSCA curriculum courses developed for the school children. But courses or texts that are developed or used are limited in scope and available only to certain grade levels. Some of the history texts make negative remarks about ANSCA, thus creating negative feelings toward Alaska Natives. Usually ANSCA is an elective course or tagged on program. Many of the school programs do not know how to tie ANSCA into the regular school programs. Yet they are able to introduce computer programs to help them reach and teach the children. Perhaps the reason school personnel take ANSCA so lightly is that it has really nothing to do with them personally, and that it is emphasizing Natives so strongly. The Women's Spirit Rising Conference passed a resolution asking that the land claims bill be created into curriculum, courses to be offered to their children. They did so for the following reasons. One, the land claims bill is affecting all rural citizenry, both Native and non-Native, directly and indirectly. That should be understood. It doesn't just affect Natives, it affects both Natives and non-Natives. They wanted that message brought through. The land claims bill is affecting change in rural lifestyles, be it social, cultural, economics, and personal. Really affecting our lives. The land claims bill deals with corporate order and matter, which are alien from the rural lifestyles of all Natives. Mainstreaming would be encouraged. But whether we want that or not, you heard testimony that they like to have their culture too. If land claims was taught in their schools, it would strongly supplement and enhance the regular educational curriculum program due to its relevancy to the outside 20th century. If they really want us to become like them, I believe if they taught us about corporate matters and order, you know, we would be really in mainstreamed. We learned by trial and error thus far, and we came pretty fast, and we showed them that we could still exist yet. But for how long? We still got 1991 yet. Okay, the land claims bill offers leadership opportunities and training to our young people in corporate and business management and board of directorships. The land claims bill was agreeable by state, federal, and Native government officials' leadership in the settlement. It's already been agreed to, it's already in existence, it's already being somewhat implemented. The land claims bill deals with all land within the region, especially around townships and villages, and the land that has economic development potential. The land claims encourages economic development in all rural Alaska, thus employment and potential tax base can be created if economic development is successful. That's a big if. 9, the land claims bill and in its effect will not be over after the year 1991 for most villages and regions. It would benefit the children who will inherit ANSCA and will have to live with the decisions being made now for both their village and regions. Not only do the women that won't want the schools to teach about land claims, they want the children to know about the potential implications if a village or regional corporation succeeds or fails on their behalf. The women want their children to realize the implications, whether what would happen if we succeed or fail with ANSCA. Other courses related to ANSCA as the corporate matters and organizational political courses. See other courses related to ANSCA such as corporate matters, organizational political courses, and economic development should also be taught. In other words, they should be a very strong social science curriculum. The women are asking for appropriate organizations, native state, municipality, and the federal to help ensure that the land claims bill will be incorporated into the curriculum offered to their children, starting at an introductory level, then on up to the complex land claims bill itself. To correctly develop an ANSCA curriculum, as have been requested by these women, it would be best to first take a statewide inventory of all land claims curriculum that is being used. You will not find much. Whether they use text material, computer programs, and or real life situations material to teach ANSCA. They would have to be a determination as to when and how to introduce ANSCA to a child. Also, the question would be to integrate ANSCA issues with other regular courses or to use a single unit approach such as U.S. History Unit. At any rate, it would be interesting to see how the school districts will react in meeting the demand for a required land claims curriculum. I believe that these Women's Spirit Rising conferees have a legitimate request. And it really has came from those people, those women that brought this about. They brought that question up. Should we have a land claims curriculum?
Well, that's fascinating, and I sure appreciate your letting me see this. I think it's very interesting. 13 years, and the situation regarding the curriculum is, as you've painted it, and yet this is this act, ANCSA, is the, in a sense, the constitution of the Alaska Native people. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Anything you wanted to add?
Perhaps. I understand you're going to be here tomorrow. I'll probably have another one paper done on different contexts.
Oh, fine.
I just came from this aspect because of these people that have helped develop this issue through the Bering Straits Women Rising Conference are still in the villages, and you're going to probably see some of them. But again, I think they had to be heard, and they really come from the grassroots. And it made a lot of impression on some of the leaders that we have here in this region of their concerns on such issues, especially for the children.
Thanks very much.
Hello. Do you think ANSCA is going to be our problem?
Well,
you think they're going to solve it?
Well, the first question's easier to answer than the second. About 700 people have told me it's a problem, and we're talking tonight about some of the problems and some of the ways in which they might be solved.
I don't know about Anska, but of course they have a lot of, Mr. Iyer said, you know, they got a lot of programs going, but it's not going to solve everything, you know. And that's what we got to bring back to our communities and tell them what we think about Anska, you know. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
My name's Jim Magdans. I guess I'm the first non-native to testify today. I hope that's acceptable.
Well, it is.
Thank you. ANCSA affected a lot of people in the state, not simply natives. One of the things that ANCSA did indirectly was to tell the state of Alaska to make subsistence use of fish and game priority use in the state. That's come up a couple of times today, and it's come up in other hearings that you've had. And I've worked in that area myself and wanted to speak to it. In 1978, the state passed a subsistence law, and it created a division within fish and game to study subsistence and to recommend to the boards of fisheries and game laws that would affect subsistence. And I work for that division today here in the Bering Straits region. I'd like to talk about two issues that some of you in the audience are probably pretty familiar with, and discuss how they were resolved and the role that the subsistence law played. One of the issues, the second one I'll talk about, is not really resolved yet. The two issues, first one involves the king crab fishery here in Norton Sound, and the other one is the Nome River salmon fishery. I'll start off with the king crab because the king crab issue seems to have pretty well been settled now. King crab have been fished by subsistence fishers in Norton Sound, in the Bering Straits, for as long as we have any record, and certainly well before that. They were the only people to use those red king crab until 1977. When some commercial crabbers, some of whom were from Nome, became aware that there were many king crab out there, and the Board of Fisheries, at the request of commercial crabbers, including some Nome fishermen, opened Norton Sound to commercial crabbing.
When was that?
1977. And since the people in the audience probably know the history, the quick history was the fishery started out relatively small for a commercial fishery. About 300,000 pounds were taken, and it grew very quickly. 2 million pounds were taken in a third year, and then it began to show signs of a crash. It declined very rapidly. The populations and the catches of commercial fishermen and subsistence fishermen as well. And one of the first issues that the subsistence division tackled in this region was the subsistence king crab fishery. And villagers, Elam, Golovin, Nome, Savunga, White Mountain, all reported that the harvest of king crab for subsistence had just dropped out the bottom. They just weren't getting them anymore. And the commercial fleet was fishing right offshore in the summertime. It was very evident. And so the crab boats came from Kodiak, from Seattle, from Dutch Harbor, and from some other places. They were not a local fleet. Although some local fishermen thought that they could participate when it opened, they were just overwhelmed by 100-foot boats, 150-foot boats, 300-foot processors. The Board of Fisheries heard information that the Subsistence Division developed and had heard testimony from local people. Matthew Io was one of those that went down. Some commercial fishermen went down to the Board of Fisheries. And the Board of Fisheries has done several things connected with Red King crab, which apparently have alleviated the problem as far as we can tell. They closed the waters around the Seward Peninsula for approximately 15 miles from the shore to commercial fishing by the summer fleet. They left open the near shore waters for subsistence fishing any time of the year with no limits, and also for commercial fishing through the ice in the wintertime, which is practiced mainly by some small-scale gnome operators who sell the fish locally. Since the board took another action the following year, we documented continued decline, and the board cut the quota for the commercial boats in half. They use a percentage of the estimated population to determine how many crab the commercial boats can have, and normally they were letting crab boats take 40% of the crab that they felt were out there to be harvested, and they cut that down to 20 in Norton Sound specifically to protect subsistence, and that law's been on the books for 3 years now. King crab populations in Alaska in general right now are in terrible conditions. If you listen to the news, the Kodiak fisheries are depressed, the Dutch Harbor fisheries depressed there. Because the law that...
Excuse me, the question was, what does the story of the king crab have to do with angst? I'm only repeating it for the record. And do you,
because the law that has been used to protect the subsistence crabbing here was a direct result of the passage of ANCSA. But the difference is, what I was leading up to with those other fisheries is that the crab fishery here in Norton Sound is now in very good health. Shows every sign of a large number of young crabs. Subsistence catches have been quite good the last 2 years. There's every reason to believe that they're going to continue to be good because the crab are young and have several more years of growth.
Could you make the point that you were about to make, that you said the law under which the commercial fishermen have been excluded is a direct result of ANCSA. You're saying the requirement that that there be protection for subsistence. Is that it?
The commercial fishermen have not been excluded from the fishery. They've been excluded from certain waters.
Yeah.
And their quota has been reduced in an effort to protect subsistence, which law resulted from ANCSA. Does that...
Maybe you could just enlarge on that for the sake of all of us.
When I venture into the legal territory, I think I'm a little bit over my head, other than saying that there's a relationship.
Okay. Well, carry on. don't let me or any of these people throw you off your course here.
Did I answer your question about the relationship?
I don't think you've really come to grips with that. I think you're saying that the pushing the commercial fishermen partway out of the crab fishery was something that you traced to ANCSA. That's your point, Mr.
Magdans. Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Prangawa, you're going to either help him out or shoot him down.
Perhaps I can help a little bit in that. The subsistence priority law, which he's referring to, came out of because of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which also resulted in ANILCA, which also provided that there would be priority or preference for subsistence resources. And this law, because of ANCSA, resulted in the subsistence priority law, which in turn affected the subsistence king crabbing in Norton Sound and the Northern Bering Sea.
Thank you very much. I think that the early drafts of ANILCA, even before it was passed, made it clear Congress was going to require Alaska to protect native subsistence. And that led, I think, to the 1978 law. But you had a second example you were going to give us.
All right. I don't know if I'm if the audience is with me on this or not. I guess just in a general sense, I think that ANCSA has had a lot of effects that we don't really associate with ANCSA in our lives. And I think the subsistence law is one example. I think there are a lot of other examples where ANCSA has affected what we do and how we do it, and we just don't make the connections back to ANCSA.
How can you work up here
then? I think that one thing that should be said, though, and what you've said coupled with Mr. Pungawi's explanation is quite true, but it shouldn't be overlooked that ANCSA actually extinguished Aboriginal rights of hunting and fishing, and that meant that having extinguished those rights, they felt a moral obligation to resurrect them in another form, that is, under state and federal law. But you've shown how they went about it. And
Well, let me.
You were going on to Fort Davis, I think.
Yeah, I was going to talk a little bit about Nome River, and this problem is still being resolved. Here, unlike crab fishery, where we have a bunch of people from outside the region coming in to fish a resource that's been used by local people, here we have a resource that's used almost solely by local people. And Fish and Game has long been concerned about the salmon fishing on the Nome River and that there are too many people and limited fish. But there's some disagreement with Fish and Game that there was even a problem. In fact, some people think Fish and Game is the problem. There was a movement 3-4 years ago in 1980 to close a major portion of the river to net fishing. There was a lot of local opposition to that, and the proposal was dropped. But the proposal in a different form came up a year ago at an advisory committee meeting, and it was clear that there was impetus from some people in town, not with Fish and Game and not necessarily fishing on the Nome River, who were concerned about what they saw as too much fishing. And so they wanted to do something about it. Our role was to exhaustively study the situation. And one of the things we looked at two things. We looked at the history of the fishery, and we looked also at the current situation in the fishery. And the history of the fishery was interesting in that the subsistence fishery on the Nome River had increased somewhat 2 or 3 times over 10 years. The commercial fishery on the Nome, on salmon in the Nome subdistrict, some of which go to the Nome River, had increased 10 times in the past 10 years, and that there was a modest increase in the harvest by sport fishermen with rod and reels. There was a perception in town that I often heard that the subsistence fishers were solely responsible for the decline of the Nome River chum salmon, and our look at the history suggested that the commercial fishery had the potential to have more impact on the stocks than the subsistence fishers, although everyone certainly affected the salmon. The more interesting part of our study was looking at what controls fishing now. And some people tend to think that Fish and Game is the only thing that controls fishing, and I don't happen to think that that's true. I think there are a lot of other things that control fishing. In the commercial fishery, the market controls fishing, whether or not someone will buy your fish at a price that you're willing to sell them at. And we're seeing that right now because the commercial fishery's been restricted, and the buyer has just announced that he doesn't think it's economic to fish anymore, and he may not buy any more fish. In the sport fishery, with the rod and reel, the people are controlled by the gear. I mean, the rod and reel is just not a real good way to catch a lot of fish, like a net is. But also, sport fishers seem to be really respond to abundance. If there are a lot of salmon, they'll fish this river. If there aren't very many salmon in the river, they'll go somewhere else. They move around in a way that a net fishery, either a commercial fishery or sport fishery, doesn't. But the most interesting controls on fishing that we found on the Nome River involved Fort Davis and the subsistence fishery there. And briefly, Fort Davis was not a miniature gnome. It did not reflect the same group of people that you'd find in a random section of Nome. Nome has quite a few people who were born outside of Alaska. It has people from 22 or more different villages. But Fort Davis, we found, had people who were only from four villages on the Seward Peninsula. And they were villages that had traditional alliances there, Wales people, Brevig Mission people, Shishmaref people, and Teller people. There are people who've married into those families, and there's some, well, you can draw kinship diagrams as we did, and you can show that, that everyone who has their camp at Fort Davis there is related to one another. This was real interesting to us because it raised some questions about what was happening in fishing and hunting all over the Seward Peninsula or all over Alaska, and to what extent there were systems that Native people recognized that controlled where people hunted and fished that Fish and Game didn't even know existed. Clearly, what we saw at Fort Davis suggested that people from other places, from down the coast, Native people at least, recognized the Wales and the Brevig Missions people's use of that site and went elsewhere. I guess the lesson that I draw from all of that, and it's not really over, is that the state has used really rather narrow means to control fish and game use, and they're squarely in a Western tradition. It uses written regulations, it uses fines, uses uniformed game wardens. It confiscates or takes away your fishing gear if you break the law. There are other cultural controls that the Native people operate under in addition to the ones that Fish and Game imposes. There are traditions of use of a fishery that are passed on from generation to generation. There are relatives to kind of educate people about how to fish and how to hunt. There's gossip when people step out of line a little bit. There's even ostracism if someone stands way out of line. The different techniques that the different cultures use to control fishing. The first witness you had tonight mentioned that local people have much to teach. And I guess what I want to say is that Fish and Game and BLM and all the other bureaucracies that are involved in managing Alaska need to understand local systems like the Nome River before they attempt to change them. And fish and game rules are based primarily on individual behavior, not on social systems. As Mr. Triggs' comment about the waterfowl, individual hunters may sometimes violate, he said, limits on waterfowl hunting, but those waterfowl are distributed to the community, so the community as a whole is within its limits. Although ANCSA did extinguish Aboriginal hunting and fishing guides rights, the recognized subsistence law that resulted from ANCSA can be a strong lever for local people to use. Aboriginal rights, however valid they may have been, were not recognized by very many non-Native Americans. ANCSA and the subsistence law are recognized, and that's an advantage. ANCSA forced us all, the Natives and the non-Natives, to recognize our disagreements. The Natives considered the land and resources were theirs alone, and much of the rest of the country felt that they owned the same thing. ANCSA forced a resolution, but it could not force understanding, and that understanding is much more difficult than any law. It's sad to me tonight that so few people are here, because I think that understanding ANCSA is so important. I don't think ANCSA is finished. I don't think any law is ever finished. Even the Constitution is amended. I think ANCSA was a beginning to understanding. It was not an ultimate solution to Native-Western relationships. I think we shouldn't focus only on its problems, but we need to look at the tools that it gave Alaskans, like the subsistence law, to help them control our future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDaniels. Oh, would anybody else like to say anything this evening? We'll be meeting again tomorrow. Well, we're meeting at the Senior Citizens Center at 10 o'clock in the morning so that the elders can participate, and then we'll be back here at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
My name is Ken Chikunarok. I'm from White Mountain Native Corporation, and I'd like to ask, I was going to ask him a question on the fishing, commercial fishing permits. I was wondering why they never did open them up very much, and because, like, say...
This is a question for you, Mr. Magdans. If you want to go to that mic, just so you'll be in a position to answer it. Yeah, maybe you could repeat the question.
Okay, in 1977, remember they opened the fishing permits for commercial fishing, and I don't remember when they closed it, and I was wondering if they were ever going to open up the fishing game permits for commercial fishing and see, like, they would... There may be, like, our children or grandchildren that would like to commercial fish in the near future, and would like to know, see if they will open up the commercial fishing in the Golovin area, and if they're going to do anything about it.
I can't speak for the legislature, which, like Congress, would have the power to change any law that it created, but I haven't seen any sign that the legislature intended to reconsider or open for additional entry the limited entry salmon fishery.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it basically, as ANCSA did, was designed to set in place a system in perpetuity, it would last forever. And it changed the rules for the resource from common ownership, or rather use of the resource from common ownership to private ownership, so that the use of the resource, at least, mm-hmm. is privately owned and transferred privately. And I don't know I don't see any sign that that's going to change in the near future for salmon. There are other fisheries that are open.
Okay, I've got another question. It's say the fishing game, say that the natives get more waterfowl than the people down in lower 48s, and the people down in lower 48s, they clear their lands and for roads, buildings, and all that other stuff they use it for, and they say that the natives in Alaska get more waterfowl, and that the waterfowl on their flight south, you know what, let me restate myself. The fishing game say that the natives get more waterfowl than the people down in lower 48s, and they clear the lands for the waterfowl and stop on their flight south. And our lands up here haven't even been spoiled or cleared away to be built. And the U.S. government someday will run out of beef and chicken due to droughts of some kind, and our substance right may be and will be completely taken away. And what will our grandchildren do if that has ever happened?
Oh, maybe that's a rhetorical question. Do you want to comment on it, Mr. Magdans?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's basically a rhetorical question. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think, like, you know,
it's just assumption of what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
I
guess I could say I recognize the concern.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to thank those who came and spoke tonight, and the others who attended and to say that we will reconvene at 10 o'clock at the Senior Citizen Center, and then we'll come back here at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. And welcome you all back at 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and any others who can hear my voice who want to come down and participate tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. And in the meantime, tomorrow we'll go to the Senior Center at 10 o'clock in the morning. So thanks very much.
Let's do more of these, Mary.